Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Taekwon. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sa, talking to you from the CITR station at UBC Point Grey Campus, located in the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Okay, it is great to be back. It's been a very long time since I've done one of these. I think the last episode I did was in sometime in November. And, you know, for those of you who remember, or for those of you who tune in to Taekwon Weekly, the last episode I did was where I gave my first half of reviews of all the movies that I watched in 2023's Vancouver International Film Festival. In the film festival, I saw a total of 22 movies. And, you know, in my last episode, which aired at some point in November, I reviewed 11 out of those 22 films. And I finished that previous episode all the way back in November. I finished it by saying that I would see you guys next week. And I am very sorry and I apologize if any of you guys tuned in next week, because, of course, there was no new Taekwon episode. You know, just in case anyone cares, I had to fly back home to Colombia in a very impromptu manner. So, you know, I went back home to my home country. I went back to my town to spend Christmas with my family. But that meant that I wasn't able to do any more Taekwon episodes until now. I arrived back in Canada a couple of days ago, and I am very excited to be back. And I am very excited to finally finish the series of my reviews of everything I watched at VIFF, at 2023's VIFF. So, without further ado, you guys have been waiting long enough for this. So here are my remaining reviews for all the remaining movies that I watched in 2023's Vancouver International Film Festival. And here we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Taekwon. Okay, this is part three of everything I watched at VIFF. So, on the 2nd of October, I watched three films. The first movie that I watched is called La Chimera, which is the newest film from director Alice Rohrwacher. Her previous film is called Happy as Lazaro, and it is this incredible, incredible movie that is just filled with, you know, philosophy and biblical references and metatextuality. You know, as the title indicates, Happy as Lazaro is very much like a modern retelling of the story of Lazaro, you know, the story of Lazaro from the Bible. But it is not just that, you know, that movie is also beautifully mixed with the story of Saint Francis of Assisi and a lot more. You know, the whole point of Happy as Lazaro is to, you know, discuss the idea that, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. In Happy as Lazaro, we see how, you know, back in the day, there was slavery and there were all of these horrible things. And then nowadays, yes, slavery is no longer a thing. But the people that used to be in power back in the day are the same people that are in power nowadays. And the people that used to suffer back in the day are the same people that are suffering today. So it is a very thought-provoking film, an incredibly philosophically dense movie. I absolutely adored Happy as Lazaro, so I was incredibly excited for La Chimera. That said, I didn't really love La Chimera. I liked it a lot, and I think it's a very, very good movie, but it didn't come together as well as Happy as Lazaro did. I guess my biggest complaints about the movie is I found La Chimera a bit unfocused. I feel like it was very meandering, very unfocused, and I feel like there were many different story threads that were just like fighting for attention at different points of the movie. There's like two different romances, one in the present, one in the past, and then there's like all this stuff with this group, and then there's like this weird boss person. It just never came together for me by the end of the movie. Another complaint that I have about this film is most of the side characters just end up becoming like a mass, like a group of characters, but I couldn't tell you what differentiates one from the other. I couldn't tell you what this guy specifically wants. They're all just like this big group. They were never developed individually, and that is something that I guess I was looking for. Something else that I was looking for is for, once again, for that very juicy metatextuality. Alice Rohrwacher did this perfectly in Happy as Lazaro by, you know, making reference to the Bible, the story of Lazaro, and by making reference to the story of Saint Francis of Assisi. And for this one, I was really excited because, like, you know, the poster is like this imagery that is very tarot, you know, very, very hangman tarot. And I was like, ooh, this is going to be oozing with symbolism. And then the title, La Chimera. I used to be obsessed with Greek mythology, but from what I remember, La Chimera was like this mythical creature that had like, you know, the head of a lion and a ram and then the tail of a snake, and it had like three different heads. And I was very excited to see what this movie would do with that. And, you know, maybe I just didn't catch it. Maybe it is there and I just didn't see it. But I kept waiting for that moment. And by the end, I'm honestly not really sure why it's called La Chimera. I mean, I guess maybe, you know, the chimera in Greek mythology is basically a creature with many different heads, but it's just like a one entity, one mass. Maybe this brings back to what I said about the side characters and how they all blend together into this big mass. Maybe the chimera is this collective of characters, is this group of people. Something else that I very much, and you know, this might be my fault, this might be me bringing expectations that I shouldn't have. But what I love the most about Happy as Lazaro is the magical element that presents itself halfway through the movie, that completely transforms the film, that completely turns it into something completely different. And I guess I was waiting for something like that to happen here in La Chimera. I was waiting for that, you know, magical element that would change everything and would breathe new life into the film. But yeah, there are some magical elements, there is some magical stuff in the film, but nowhere near to the extent of meaningful and impactful than it was in Happy as Lazaro. So overall, I liked La Chimera. You know, if I were to give it a score in between 1 and 10, I would give it a 7 because I think it's a very good movie. That said, it didn't really come together. Many different side stories that ended up fighting for attention at different parts of the movie. And then the side characters are a bit unexplored and, you know, they end up becoming this mass. Then the next movie I saw on the 2nd of October was actually an incredibly beautiful movie that I really loved. It is an animated film called Robot Dreams. Robot Dreams is directed by Pablo Berger. I have seen one other movie from Pablo Berger called Blancanieves. It kind of is a retelling of the story of Snow White, but with like bullfighting, with bullfighting in Spain. And then something that is also very unique about Blancanieves is that the whole movie is a silent film. The film is basically a silent film, kind of like The Artist. In my opinion, this one, Blancanieves, is even better than The Artist, and I am a fan of The Artist, but I think this one is even better. And I love Blancanieves. I thought it was very unique, very specifically Spanish, and I couldn't wait to see what he would do next. And then he came out with this animated film called Robot Dreams, and I had seen the trailers, I had seen some of the pictures, and I was like, okay, it looks cute, you know, the animation looks cute. It's like a dog befriending a robot, like, you know, this is, it's gonna be cute, but nothing else. I kind of went in expecting something like that, but I was blown away by just how affected emotionally I ended up being by this film. I can't believe I'm saying this, but out of all the movies I've seen in 2023, Robot Dreams is the one that has reminded me the most of past lives, especially the ending. Oh my god, I can't believe I was in tears watching this freaking movie, this animated movie about a cute robot and like a cute dog. Other stuff that I loved about Robot Dreams is the movie is called Robot Dreams for a reason. There are many moments in the film where we see the dreams that the robot is having. And these dream sequences, I loved them. They were incredibly surrealist, incredibly colorful and creative. And I thought all of those surrealist scenes, all of those dream sequences really came together and you know, really elevated this movie to a whole new level. There is one dream in particular that I absolutely loved where, you know, you're seeing the screen and the image on the screen is full of, you know, it's full of snow. It's full of snow. And in movies, when you go to watch a film, there are things called letterboxes, you know, that are like the black screens that are like at the very top and at the very bottom of the screen. And the point is, in this film, when you're watching this dream where the screen is full of snow, suddenly the snow starts falling into the letterboxes. You know, it's very meta. It's playing with the film medium in and of itself, and it just filled me with joy and sense of wonder. When I was watching Robot Dreams, I was a bit concerned about how meandering it was. It felt like every couple of scenes was like a side quest or like a side thing, you know, that we have to do before we do the final thing, before we do the end goal. That said, by the end, it all clicked and everything made perfect sense. And I finally realized that all of those scenes that I had found meandering and pointless throughout the entirety of the movie were actually just, you know, a depiction of life. You know, stuff in life doesn't necessarily build up to a certain point. We meet different people that never come back to our lives. We interact with people just once and then they disappear. And that's life. You know, life is nothing but a sequence of interactions. And by the end, I was like, okay, I get it. I understand and I love it. It's all part of the whole and it's all helping you make this big, big point. So in conclusion, I love Robot Dreams. I thought it was a great movie. I think I like it even more than Blancanieves. And I would give Robot Dreams an 8 out of 10. I think it's a very strong movie. It's a great movie. It's a heart-wrenching movie. But yeah, I loved it. Now, the last movie I saw on the 2nd of October is Close to You, which is directed by Dominique Savage. And it stars Elliot Page after his transition. I'm sure you guys are aware, Elliot Page used to be known as Ellen Page and acted in a bunch of movies such as Juno and Inception. I might be mistaken, but I think this is the first film he stars in now that he has become a man. So I was very interested in watching it just because of that. And I was very impressed by his performance. Elliot Page's performance in Close to You is absolutely amazing. An incredible performance. Very subtle, but also very powerful and explosive when he needs it to be. First thing I'll say is the story of Close to You, it follows, a trans man who is going back home to his family for his father's birthday. And, you know, throughout the film, this main character is put in difficult, unfortunate situations with people who are not as open-minded and who are not willing to accept him for the person that he has become. Elliot Page has made it very clear in a variety of interviews that this is not autobiographical. This is not his life story. That said, I would guess that he has used a lot of his own life experience and he put it into this character because the character felt very real, very raw, very believable. His performance felt very, very believable. I thought this movie was very good. Basically, everything that takes place between the main character and his family, that relationship, I thought all of that was amazing. You know, some of the intense scene, some of the tension-inducing scenes where some characters confront the protagonist for who he is, all of those scenes I thought were incredibly well made. That said, there is kind of a B storyline in the movie of the main character, the protagonist, and a friend that he used to have back in middle school or in high school. I don't really remember. I don't think that storyline worked as well as the main storyline, the one of him and his family. But all in all, I think Close to You was a very good movie, and I would give it a 7 out of 10. But then on the 4th of October, I did watch another movie, and this one is called A Normal Family. And this is a South Korean movie that features anything but a normal family. This family is anything but normal. This is an incredibly intense, incredibly thrilling, incredibly thought-provoking and kind of disturbing movie. At certain points, it reminded me a lot of Parasite. You know, I'm not comparing how great they are, because, you know, Parasite is one of the greatest movies of all time, but it reminded me of Parasite in the sense that these are both South Korean movies that are great at escalating tension and making, you know, situations escalate further and further and further to the point where everything explodes and, you know, all hell breaks loose. Parasite was exceptional at doing that, and A Normal Family is another great example of that. What I love the most about A Normal Family is by far the two main characters. And I'm talking about, you know, the main father and his brother. One of them claims to be very righteous, you know, a very righteous person who cares about humanity, who cares for the greater good. And then at the other side, we have the brother who, he's a lawyer, and he basically ends up defending some pretty sketchy people with the excuse that, you know, it's just a job. Someone will do it, so he might as well do it, and he does it well, and he gets money, and he sustains his family. So that's how he defends his actions. But then at the other side, the other brother, who claims to be very righteous, he is a doctor, you know, he cares for humanity. And throughout the movie, these two characters are put in situations where they have to wrestle with their beliefs, wrestle with their moral standings, and these characters are pushed to the very extreme to see if they are willing to break those beliefs, if they are willing to break those moral standings that they so much believe in. And I thought all of that was fascinating, you know, from a philosophical perspective, was incredibly thought-provoking. And once again, the escalation of tension and the escalation of events in this movie was just beautiful. My one little problem with the movie, and it's not really a problem, it's more of something that me subjectively I would have enjoyed. I would have loved if the ending, and by the ending I don't mean like the last 30 minutes, no, I mean like the last shot of the movie. I would have loved it if the last shot of the movie, the last moment of the film, would have been a bit more ambiguous. But that's just me. You know, it might work perfectly for you. But all in all, I thought A Normal Family was an absolute banger. Just incredibly entertaining, incredibly thought-provoking, with some great performances, some great philosophical questioning, some, you know, philosophical ponderings. And all in all, if I were to give it a score, I would give it a 9 out of 10, because I thought A Normal Family was amazing. And that is it for part 3 of Everything I Watched at VIFF. There is one more part remaining. I hope you enjoyed this, but that is it for this video. Goodbye.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
MRG Live is pleased to present the legendary DJ Shadow live at the Vogue Theater on January 23rd. Don't miss your chance to catch this pioneering producer performing music from his latest release, Action Adventure, alongside his rich 3-decade-long catalog, which includes collaborations with artists such as Run the Jewels, Nas, and De La Soul, among others. For tickets, head to admitone.com and search for DJ Shadow.
Hey Vancouver! For fans of Ocean Alley, Flip Turn, and Still Woozy, alt rockers Juice are bringing their signature blend of rock, pop, R&B, and hip hop to the Biltmore Cabaret on February 3rd, with support from Hembry. Tickets are on sale now. Get yours at admitone.com.
Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
If you buy a bike from us, bring it back when you're done using it, and we'll give you half of your money back, as long as you took care of it. If it needs repairs, we'll split the cost with you.
Yep, you heard us right. We'll give you crisp dollar bills for half the original price of any used bike that you buy from us, minus the cost of repairs.
For more information about our buyback policy and to stay up to date on any COVID-19 inspired changes, find us online at thebikekitchen.com.
Sprouts is a 100% volunteer and student-run organization at UBC. Through the many initiatives, Sprouts aims to make healthy, affordable, and sustainably produced food accessible to everyone on campus. Sprouts is based out of Sprouts Cafe in the basement of the Life Building. With rising food insecurity on campus, they've dedicated practices to making high-quality food and produce available to all through the cafe, community fridge, produce market, and free meal distribution. Learn more about these many initiatives and volunteer opportunities on Instagram at @UBCSprouts.
By the way, this is somebody's favorite show! Hi, Dan Shakespeare here. You know, for most of the stuff that I play, you probably think that I'm much older, but you know what? Most of you are probably way off, because I'm only 23 years old. Tune in to The Shakespeare Show between noon and 1 p.m. on Wednesdays. It's songs from before the 1920s to alternative stuff today, plus jokes and riddles, all sorts of fun stuff. Just put any of it on your iTunes if you need to. Pretty soon it'll be coming out on albums.
Welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Okay, I hope you all enjoyed that musical break. That, of course, was September from the band Earth, Wind & Fire. And the reason why I'm playing this song is because this song is heavily featured in one of the movies that I just reviewed. This song is heavily featured in the animated movie Robot Dreams, directed by Paolo Berger. Once again, charming movie, amazing film. I really enjoyed watching it at 2023's Vancouver International Film Festival. If you missed it, that is what I'm talking about in this episode. In this episode, I'm finally finishing my reviews of all 22 films that I watched in 2023's Vancouver International Film Festival. I'm only missing a couple more movies, a couple more reviews, and I'll be done with my coverage of the film festival. But yeah, that is why I played September. So now, without further ado, here comes the last part of my VIF coverage. You know, my last couple of reviews, the last couple of reviews that I'm missing out of everything that I watched at 2023's Vancouver International Film Festival. And without further ado, here we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Take One. Okay, this is the fourth and final part of everything I watched at VIFF. So, as I've been saying at the beginning of the past couple of videos, the Vancouver International Film Festival happened here in Vancouver from the 28th of September until the 8th of October. I was able to watch 22 total movies. So, on the 7th of October, I actually saw the most movies I saw in one day of the film festival, and the first movie I watched was The Boy and the Heron, which is Hayao Miyazaki's newest movie. Now, I've already reviewed The Boy and the Heron, so I won't talk about The Boy and the Heron, but if you haven't seen my review and, you know, you care about what I think or what I have to say about The Boy and the Heron, definitely check that video out. Then the movie I watched right after The Boy and the Heron was a movie called Monster from the director Hirokazu Koreeda. I loved Monster. I was so excited for this movie because I love the director. I think Hirokazu Koreeda is a very interesting filmmaker. I think my two favorite movies of his are, you know, Shoplifters and Broker. That said, even though I love those movies very, very much, I do understand the criticism that is often lobbed at this filmmaker, and that criticism is that he always makes the same movie, that he keeps making the same movie over and over again. Basically, both of the movies that I love the most, Broker and Shoplifters, they're both movies about found family, where this group of misfits come together to create this family unit, and they end up finding a baby or a child that ends up joining them, and then towards the end, everyone's crying, and it's very sad and emotional, and I love the movies, but yes, they are very similar. And yes, this filmmaker does tend to kind of explore the same ideas and the same narratives in a lot of his movies. That said, I still love them. You know, even though he kind of makes the same movie over and over again, I still very much enjoy them. So I was excited for this one. I saw the title, Monster, and I didn't read the synopsis, I didn't watch the trailer, I didn't read anything else, but just by the title, I was like, ooh, this sounds different, you know, this sounds like it's not gonna be another story of, you know, a family unit stumbling into a baby or a child and adopting them. Then I heard that this time he didn't actually write the screenplay, that it was someone else writing the script for Monster, and that, once again, piqued my attention even more, because that is yet another evidence that this is going to be a different movie from him, that this is going to be unlike any of the films he has made before. I went to watch it on the 7th, and I absolutely love it, and what I love the most is, okay, first of all, just how different it is to the previous movies that Hirokazu Koreeda has made. This is definitely not a wholesome movie about a family finding a baby and having to deal with that and, you know, creating an unconventional family unit. Nah. This is another movie that is very much interested in the idea of, is there such a thing as an objective truth? And I didn't know this coming into the movie, but I think it would make a better experience if you know this going in, so I'll go ahead and say it. This film, Monster, is told using a similar narrative style to movies such as Rashomon and The Last Duel. For those of you who haven't seen Rashomon and The Last Duel, incredible movies, by the way. Rashomon is one of my favorite Akira Kurosawa films, and The Last Duel is an incredibly underrated Ridley Scott film. But, you know, the style that this movies use is basically they tell you the same event, they tell you the same story from different perspectives. And the point of all of these films, the point of Rashomon and the point of The Last Duel, is to question the idea of an objective truth, is to show you that we as human beings, we are subjective beings, and the stuff that we perceive, the stuff that we see, is not really an objective reality, but just our perception of a reality. It is our subjective view of that reality. And this movie, Monster, uses that same narrative structure. They tell you the events that happen in 1 week from three different perspectives. The perspective of the mother, the perspective of a teacher, and then the perspective of one of the children that are involved in the stuff that happens in 1 week. And I think this movie used that Rashomon narrative style to perfection. I was very impressed by how the same events could appear to be completely different depending on whose perspective we're seeing them through. You know, in one perspective, the events might appear to be sinister and dark and scary, but then in another perspective, the same events suddenly seem loving and joyful and happy, and that just completely blew my mind. The way this movie unpeels its many different layers, and, you know, every time they keep showing you more and more and more and more and more of the narrative until you finally get it that, yes, you know, there is no such thing as an objective truth, but seeing all of the subjective experiences come together to create a whole, a kind of cohesive whole, was an absolutely magical experience. I loved Monster. And, you know, Monster, by the way, was the movie that ended up winning the Audience Award at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival, you know, for this category, for the category of special presentations. It, you know, it won the Audience Award. It was the movie that people love the most. And I think there is a good reason why. This was an incredible, incredible movie. If I were to give it a score, I would give it a 9 out of 10. I think this film was amazing. Now, the next movie I saw on the 7th of October was a movie that I've been dying to talk about ever since I saw it. It is called The Taste of Things. I love The Taste of Things. I think it's an amazing, amazing movie, and I'll tell you why in a second. But I'll just start by saying that watching this movie was by far my favorite cinematic experience in the entire festival. It was wild. So I'll start by saying that this film, The Taste of Things, is directed by Vietnamese director Tran Anh Hung, which some of you might know. Tran Anh Hung is most famous for directing a movie called The Smell of Green Papayas, or The Scent of Green Papayas. And if you have seen The Smell of Green Papayas or The Scent of Green Papayas, you know that this filmmaker loves to make movies that very much, you know, that very much trigger your senses, that very much interact with your five senses, particularly your sense of smell and your sense of taste. You know, when you're watching Scent of Green Papaya, you can almost taste the dishes that the characters are cooking. You can almost smell that green papaya. You can smell the food. You can smell the environment. They are, yeah, movies that very much engage with your five senses. They stimulate your five senses. I think this film, The Taste of Things, is that, but on steroids. It is even more of that, you know? If The Scent of Green Papaya engages with your senses, The Taste of Things is a full-blown sensory overload. This film is insane. I have never felt that hungry watching a movie than I did when I was watching The Taste of Things. My mouth was constantly watering. It got to a point where I literally had to start chewing gum halfway through the movie because of how much I was salivating and how hungry I was feeling. Because basically, The Taste of Things, as the title indicates, it's a whole movie dedicated to showing the beauty of the culinary arts. You know, the beauty of cooking, the beauty of making dishes. And oh my god, did it make me hungry. And not only me, but everyone that was watching that movie with me. And that is why I say that watching this film at the film festival was my favorite cinematic experience of the entirety of VIFF. It was because they screened this film at 6 p.m. where, you know, people are starting to get hungry. And then they played this film, The Taste of Things. And every time that a delicious meal appeared on screen, you could just hear everyone in the auditorium just going, or ooh, or it's, you know, making weird sounds like that. And then the funniest thing is, after we all collectively moaned about the food that we were watching, then everyone just broke into laughter, and everyone started laughing because we couldn't believe, you know, what was happening in that theater. The cinematography, the set design, the way this film frames food and shows you food is some of the most sumptuous, sensual stuff I've ever seen. I guess the best way I could put it is this movie makes food look like pornography. It makes cooking look like pornography. It is incredibly sensual, incredibly appetizing, and your mouth is just watering by the beauty that you're seeing on screen. That said, this movie's not for everyone. It is incredibly slow. You know, if you've seen The Scent of Green Papaya, you kind of know the pacing that you should be expecting. This movie is very much paced in a similar way to that one. It is a very, very, very slow movie, and the plot is there. There is a story, but it is not really the focus. So if that doesn't sound like your cup of tea, don't watch it. That said, you know, I love movies that make me feel things that I've never felt before. And I've just never seen a movie that has made me this hungry. I've never seen a movie that has just shown the culinary arts in such a beautiful, sensual, and profound way. I guess the best way I can put it is the first 30 minutes of this film, and I'm not kidding, the first 30 minutes of this movie is nothing but shots of people cooking. And it is frankly hypnotizing. It is delicious. My mouth is watering right now just remembering some of the food they made. But yeah, I love the taste of things. If I were to give it a score, I would give it a 9 out of 10. It's an amazing movie. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. It doesn't only stimulate your senses. It is a full-blown sensory overload. The acting is amazing. The cinematography is amazing. The set design is amazing. But who am I kidding? The food. The food is the protagonist. And the food is incredible. Then, the last movie I watched on the 7th of October was actually Priscilla, the newest film from Sofia Coppola. And Priscilla is also a movie that I have already reviewed. There is a full-length review in this channel. So if you care about my thoughts of Priscilla, definitely go check that one out. And then, on the 8th of October, the last day of the festival, I saw three more films. The first movie I saw on the 8th of October is called About Dry Grasses. And it is a Turkish film, I believe, yes. It is a Turkish film directed by Nuri Bilge Ceylan. This director has directed movies such as Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, Winter Sleep, The Wild Pear Tree, Usak, you know, films that are very famous Turkish movies that I've heard about for the longest time. So I'm glad I finally got to watch one of his movies, and I thought About Dry Grasses was amazing. I was a bit scared going into the movie because all I've heard about this filmmaker is that his movies can be very slow. And also this film About Dry Grasses is 3 hours and 15 minutes long, somewhere around that mark. So I went into the film a bit scared, but I absolutely loved it. Incredible, incredible film. The cinematography is amazing. Some of the vistas that we see, some of the environments that we see is just absolutely breathtaking. The snowy mountains and, you know, the endless fields of dry grass, hence the name, About Dry Grasses. The protagonist is a photographer, and every once in a while we see some of the photos that the protagonist has taken, and they're just mesmerizing, breathtaking, hypnotic. Apart from that, I love the script. I think the script is one of the strongest things about this movie. It's one of those screenplays where, in page, someone could tell you, like, nothing really happens. That said, in every single conversation, there is so much tension, there is so much emotion that is building up in every single conversation that I was constantly engaged and I was constantly at the edge of my seat. The dialogue in this film is just some of the best dialogue I've ever seen. In my opinion, writing dialogue that is like imbued with philosophy and imbued with philosophical undertones, it's never easy. I've tried it in multiple screenplays that I've written, but it always ends up sounding preachy. It sounds like I'm teaching something instead of sounding organic and sounding like something that a real character would actually say. That said, here in this film, in About Dry Grasses, I swear, so many of the conversations are so philosophically rich. And they always feel organic. They always feel like real conversations. I absolutely loved it. And what I loved the most about this film, or what impressed me the most about this film, is the fact that the main character is a jerk. The main character is an absolute asshole. He's just not a great human being. That said, he is fascinating. And that is evidence of a great, great script. If, you know, if this film was able to keep us interested in the story of an absolute asshole, that means something. I thought the film was fascinating, the dialogue was incredible, the philosophical undertones throughout the entire movie were incredibly well developed, especially the perspective of the protagonist and the way he saw the world. You know, he's very pessimistic, he's very nihilistic, I guess, in the way he sees the world, in the way he sees the people that surround him. But then throughout the film, he gets confronted by different characters who challenge his views, who challenge his opinions, and all of those conversations were just delicious. I ate them up. Absolutely incredible. So yeah, I loved about Dragrassus, and I'm definitely interested in checking out more of the movies from this filmmaker. Now, the second movie I saw on the 8th of October is called How to Have Sex. This film is directed by Molly Manning Walker, and I thought this movie was very good. You know, there are some party scenes that are really well made, really well shot. You know, the flashing lights and the sounds and the bodies and you know, everyone rubbing against each other. You know, the cinematography of this film was really able to put me in these situations, to put me in the middle of these parties. Throughout the film, it gets to a point where these parties start feeling repetitive and draining. But I do think it is intentional. You know, you are meant to feel what the characters are feeling. You're meant to feel what the protagonist is feeling. And by this point in the film, she's getting tired of this. She's not enjoying it anymore. So it makes sense that we, as the audience, we also start finding them repetitive and draining, kind of like a place you have to escape. Of course, you know, I won't go into detail. I won't spoil the movie. But then, you know, the movie's not just fun parties for the entirety of its runtime. And there, you know, there's one point where things really get serious. And then for the entirety of the movie, we're stuck dealing with the repercussions of the serious stuff that happens. I enjoyed it. I would give it a 7 out of 10. I think it's a very good movie, once again. And now, the last movie I saw on the 8th of October, and the very last movie I saw for the entirety of the Vancouver International Film Festival, was a movie called Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World. And I don't even know what to say about this movie, man. I guess the best way I could put it is this film reminded me a lot of Tu Va Bien. You know, Jean-Luc Godard's Tu Va Bien. I don't know if you've seen Tu Va Bien. I had to watch it for one of my film classes here at UBC, and my professor, when we were about to watch Tu Va Bien, she literally introduced the movie by saying that Godard wants you to hate this movie. He made a movie so egregious that breaks all the laws, all the rules of common narratives, all the rules, all the conventions, because he wants you to hate it. He wants you to ask yourself, why do I expect certain things from cinema? Why do I expect certain things from movies, I guess? And this film, once again, reminded me a lot of that. This film felt like another movie that desperately wanted me to hate it. This film is incredibly transgressive. It is unlike anything I've ever seen. First of all, it is a plotless movie. It doesn't really have a narrative. You're just following this very loud, outspoken protagonist as she's trying to, you know, do certain things in order to get this video made. She basically works for like a TV company, and they are about to make a PSA. And the whole movie is pretty much that. It's you know, you're following this protagonist driving from one place to the other, talking to one person, talking to another person, paying this person, then grabbing lenses from this place, grabbing lenses from this other place, and then at the very end of the movie, you finally see them shooting the PSA. Sounds conventionally enough, kind of, right? Well, it ain't. Because here's the deal. First of all, when the film begins, it starts by letting you know that this is a movie that is in conversation with an older movie, with an older Romanian movie. And at first, I had no idea what that means. Well, what that means is that every couple of minutes, the film cuts away to scenes from a completely different movie. But basically, you're intercutting between past and present. You're intercutting in between this modern transgressive film and then this older, more conventional movie. And that part, I very much enjoyed. I like that idea. You know, it's unlike anything I've ever seen. It's novel, it's transgressive, but it's new, you know? But then, there are some other transgressive moments in this movie that I'm like, oh my god, you just want us to hate it. There's a part where the movie just completely turns into a slideshow. You know, for 5 whole minutes, we're just seeing pictures of graves right next to the street. There's no music in the background. There are no sound effects. There's no dialogue. There's no monologue. It's just silence and pictures of graves. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I kept looking at my friend. I kept looking at everyone in the theater. Everyone was kind of restless looking at each other. We didn't know what we were watching. But then when that was over, I was like, okay, surely that is like the most transgressive and, you know, weird this movie's gonna get. But oh, no, 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 okay? At the end, as I previously said, by the end of the movie, we actually see the characters shooting this PSA. They begin shooting with the first actor and his family. And they place the camera down, and we're seeing from the perspective of the camera. And then, they roll camera, and then they do the first take. But they don't like the first take. And instead of cutting away and then showing us once again, once they're doing a different take, they leave all the moments of in between. Which means that the last 30 minutes of this movie is one uninterrupted shot where you're seeing these characters trying to get this shot. There's like a moment where like the director of the ad, the director of the PSA says like, oh, I don't like that sign in the background. And once again, instead of cutting away, we see it all, okay? We see the PAs walking to the background, finding a ladder, placing it down, going up the ladder, bringing the sign down, then grabbing the ladder once again, hiding it from the camera, coming back into the foreground. In the meantime, we see the actors in the foreground kind of getting restless. You know, it's warm and it's miserable and rain starts falling. And then you hear the protagonist in the background, filming one of her... very egregious, very loud TikToks, and oh my god, and it goes like that for 30 minutes. So yeah, this is what I mean. This is a movie that desperately wants you to hate it. This is an incredibly transgressive, an incredibly weird movie. That said, I kind of enjoyed it. I kind of liked how weird it was. I kind of liked it for its charm, and I also hate the fact that I kind of liked it. So if I were to give it a score, I would give it a 7 out of 10, but I honestly don't know what to say about this movie. The title is a meme. The movie is a meme. Everything in this film is a meme. It's just poking fun at you. It is desperately trying to annoy you, and yet I kind of liked it. I liked how weird it was. So that's that for Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World. And those are all the movies that I saw at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. Now, I guess I'll end this video on my VIFF coverage by sharing with you guys my ranking of all 22 films that I saw at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. I'll probably put a picture right here of my ranking so that you guys can see what movies I liked the most in comparison to each other. But that is it for this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. But now, before I sign off, there's a couple of people that I have to thank. Special thanks to everyone at VIFF. Thank you for making this year's festival an absolutely incredible experience. Thank you to everyone at MPMG, the Murray Peterson Marketing Group, Angela Poon, Ariane Belvila, Ines Mean, Laura Murray. You guys are absolutely incredible. Thank you so, so much. Also, thank you to Katia DeBock from the NFB, the National Film Board of Canada. Thank you for believing in the show. Thank you for believing in me. And thank you for always reaching out to me with potential interviews and cool opportunities. Also, thank you to everyone who agreed to be interviewed for Take One. Sarah Greenwood, Katie Spencer, Sam Green, and Karsten Wall. Thank you so, so much. And of course, thank you guys for watching. That is it for my coverage of this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. Stay tuned for more videos. Goodbye. And welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. And that is officially it. Those are all the movies that I saw in 2023's Vancouver International Film Festival. What an amazing experience. Special thanks to everyone at VIFF. Special thanks to everyone who, was interviewed in the show. I really appreciate it. It was genuinely one of my favorite experiences in 2023. And thank you all so much for tuning in. Thank you all so much for, listening to what I have to say about this many different movies. But that is it for this week's episode of Take One. Stay tuned, not next week, but the week before then. That would be Tuesday the 23rd, I believe. That is when Take One will be coming back, where I will be talking about my favorite movies of 2023. That is it for this week's episode. Good. Bye, and here, goodbye.